Please the court, counsel. My name is David Jones. I'm here to represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. This is a prosecution's appeal under Rule 4 of the Colorado Appellate Rules. It's an appeal of the district court's granting of a new trial under Crim P 33. What occurred here was the defendant was placed on trial on a two-count information, those counts being vehicular eluding and DUI. The evidence occurred over a two-day period. Deliberations occurred over the next 2 days. The jury eventually returned a verdict of guilty on the vehicular eluding and not guilty on the DUI. After the verdict was rendered and before sentencing occurred, one or two of the jurors indicated through a letter to the court that they felt uncomfortable with their verdict, that there was some misbehavior in the jury room, and that they believed that the court should do something about that. At that initial proceeding, the sentencing hearing, the court was not in a position to do anything about it. No motion had been filed. Defense counsel asked for a continuance to address that issue. He began an investigation and ultimately submitted three affidavits from three of the jurors that were on that jury panel. Those jurors indicated in the affidavits similar information, but that information was very vague. Specifically, they indicated that a juror, unidentified, told them that the charge, vehicular eluding, was a minor charge based upon his experience. Apparently, he described to the jury an experience he had where he was charged with DUI and a similar charge, and he described that it was a traffic infraction, I believe is how at least one of the affidavits put it. But ultimately what was conveyed was this was not a very serious offense. The other thing that was discussed was the introduction of a dictionary definition for the word elude. The affidavits don't indicate what that dictionary definition was, but they do indicate that the definition was brought to the attention of the jurors, but after discussion, they decided to discard or discredit that definition and proceed as they had been instructed in the instruction one, which tells them not to consider anything outside of those instructions. The court, with only that information that contained in the affidavits, granted the motion for new trial under Crim P 33.
A request for a hearing?
A hearing was granted.
I mean an evidentiary hearing.
A hearing was scheduled and was available to the defense, but they chose to rely only on their brief and affidavits.
The prosecution did not request a hearing, I guess.
That is correct. The prosecution didn't present any evidence of their own either, other than an offer of proof that the only definitions that they encountered in their research of dictionaries that were available to them was that elude was defined as escape through the means of cleverness and skill.
Rather, the record doesn't even show what dictionary it was that was referred to.
That's correct. The first part of my discussion with you is that this burden under 33 rests upon the defendant to establish that extraneous information or outside influences were introduced into the jury's deliberations. They failed to do that. I'm not going to dwell on that. I think the record is fairly clear on that in that regard as far as what evidence was available to the court. What I wanted to focus on is whether or not those affidavits could be introduced as it pertains to the juror's comment of this was not a serious offense.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I don't think either party discussed the Supreme Court's decision in Kendrick, which came down, actually, I think after the defendant's brief had been filed, but maybe shortly before you filed a reply brief. And I think you made brief reference to it. But that decision on numerous occasions, although it's not dealing with the type of issue here where there was some sort of legal issue being introduced into the jury deliberations, but it stressed on several occasions that legal content might be an exception to the 606B rule. In your opinion, was this information that was expressed by the unknown juror, did that constitute legal content? And if so, does that present an exception to 606B?
It doesn't. What he was doing was giving his impressions, his opinions regarding the seriousness or lack of seriousness of the charge. Now, this type of conduct, this type of discussion, while I can't certainly confirm for you in every case, in many cases does arise. Kendrick was discussed in my reply brief. And Kendrick, as well as my reply brief, goes through different cases where the information is extraneous, and thus the 606B does not prevent its introduction, and it does identify those as opposed to those that are not extraneous. This is confined to the deliberation process. It is knowledge or information that is contained by the juror that is general in nature and is not specific to the facts or parties involved in the case. And that's what Kendrick really deals with. There may be some offhanded dicta talking about legal content, but I think what they're discussing there is more like I said, I think it was in my opening brief, where they're introducing the actual legal concept. In other words, bringing in the statute book and saying, here's the possible penalties for this. This is not a big deal. That's very different than an opinion, an offhand opinion at that, saying, yeah, I had a DUI, a similar charge, no big deal.
What if the juror had brought in an element of the offense, say, in his experience that an element of the looting required an element that was in addition to or different than the court's instruction?
Also in Kendrick, they make reference to a case, and I can't cite it offhand, where they made reference to going outside of the definitions, the jury definitions. And it was indicated in that case that when the jury discusses things that may be wrong, may be, actually I know what it is, it was a Tenth Circuit case, it was United States versus Benally. In that case, they go through a list of those types of cases that don't involve extraneous information. And jury misconduct, when I use that term, I use it more broadly than the legal term we're using here today. When they engage in misconduct behind the scenes, that being they allow their prejudices and biases to become involved in the deliberative process, those cases, for example, Tanner versus United States, Benally, D'Angelo, and Weiser, when they start allowing those things to be introduced, it's covered by 606B. It doesn't fit one of the exceptions. And even though we recognize as a legal community that there are going to be problems in the jury process, we also recognize we've got to protect that process because it's the best one out there. And that protection, that ideal in this jury process must be protected, outweighs our efforts to seek perfection. Because ultimately, it's a human situation that's being involved in a jury process.
Also, in your brief, I received the impression that your basic argument was that a juror's past personal experience brought to bear on the deliberations is not extraneous information. I gather today, however, from what you've said, that it may be extraneous information if it involves facts that are peculiar to this case, such as, for example, a juror who has gone past the crime scene numerous times during his lifetime, personal experience, but who insists that the scene is different from what the evidence has disclosed during trial. Is that what you're suggesting?
I am. I am. In going through the research in preparation for today, I recognize that it was likely the court would ask, what differentiates the circumstances here from someone doing as you've described? And that's what it is. It's the general things that a juror might bring into the jury room, as opposed to facts that are relevant to the trial itself, the issue at hand, or the parties. And that's what distinguishes this from those cases that are cited in the cases I presented in my briefs.
In this case, you say facts relevant to the trial in this case. In this situation, though, a juror brought in facts that were mandatorily irrelevant in talking about the penalties that could occur, because the court gave an instruction, didn't it, saying you can't be concerned with what the penalties might be.
The court did. But what the juror did here was express an opinion about possible penalties, essentially a legal opinion. And what's different than what those other cases are talking about, they're talking about facts, as Judge Criswell talked about. The crime scene, knowledge of a witness and the veracity of a witness, gaining information through the press specific to the case that is not introduced, but then is introduced into the jury room. Those are the types of facts that we're talking about, not opinions or legal conclusions that are brought in from outside the jury room.
What if he had brought in a copy of the Colorado Revised Statutes or an article that talked about what the penalty is for vehicle looting? Would that have made a difference?
It would have. That clearly is an identified item that is extraneous to the deliberative process that is brought in to try to influence the jury. And that brings in the Harlan factors, or the Waddle factors, where they go through what is it that we're looking at, those six factors that they talk about, whether it relates to a critical issue, whether it's authoritative. And here, that would have strong authoritative value, and could it be used to prejudice the defendant, that sixth and final and probably most important factor, whether the information is likely to influence a typical juror to the detriment of the defendant. Now, the statutes, if they demonstrate that this is a very serious crime, could be used to the detriment of the defendant, as I described in my reply brief. The more serious, the more invested the jury becomes in either convicting or acquitting. If it's more serious, the jury is going to want to engage in punitive sanctions.
Counsel, is there anything in the record to support that? Sounds like something that may or may not be borne out by data. Is there anything in the record to support
that? Cited to a case, I don't remember what case it was in particular, but it does describe the passions and prejudices that occur when that type of information is introduced. And what they were saying in at least that case, that the more serious the offense, the more the passions and prejudice become engaged. The less serious, the less so.
It seems to me that you could also, in a typical case, draw exactly the opposite conclusion. If the case was very close, factually, the jury might be influenced to acquit if they thought that if they convicted the person would receive life. It might have an opposite influence as well. I think perhaps what influence it might have, either generally in a specific case, is probably more speculation than a good observation.
It may be, but that's ultimately what it is speculation. And again, we come back to whose burden is it? And the burden is on the defendant to establish that there was prejudice. And if they're relying on speculation, they haven't established or haven't met that burden under Rule 33. At this point, I would ask to reserve any further comment.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Eric Fenster. My registration number is 33264. The trial court properly granted defendant Appley's motion for a new trial, finding two distinct areas of juror misconduct. The court evaluated the evidence before it, considered the limitations of 606B, employed the objective test espoused by Weiser and Harlan, and found grounds for a new trial based upon its finding in each instance, both instances, that the jury was exposed to extraneous information and that there existed a likely reasonable possibility of prejudice to the defendant. In the first instance, the district court made findings that a member of the jury provided information to the panel that the offense of vehicular looting was a minor offense. One of the affidavits characterized this as a slap on the wrist. In hearing the panel's questions of the appellant attorney, I think it's important to point out that the context in which this reference was made. It is undisputed that this characterization was made prior to the rendering of a verdict, and it was considered by at least some of the jurors who described themselves as holdouts. I think it's fair to say
holdouts. Also, isn't that kind of evidence clearly inadmissible when we're talking about whether it would sway the jurors' views? I mean, it's one thing to be saying, here's some extraneous information that was introduced, and that's under 606B. It's another thing to say, well, here's what the jurors thought about it, because doesn't the law establish an objective test for that?
I think it does, Your Honor.
Okay.
But those are referenced in the affidavit, so perhaps. But I think, you know, not only that, but there's also a reference in the affidavits to other evidence that may be inadmissible under 606B. For example, the definition of a lewd, and, you know, the jurors talked about in the affidavits how that may have influenced their decision. The court specifically did not rely, you know, the court's order and opinion did not rely on those findings.
Counsel, what if the juror here had not referred to his personal experience, but have said, heck, in generally, heck, this is only a minor offense? Would that be extraneous information?
I don't think so necessarily. I think it would be a violation of the court's order.
Well, fair enough. But we don't get into the jurors' violations on that basis. Then what is the difference? What is the essential difference between saying, heck, this is just a minor experience, or saying, based on my personal experience, this is just a minor offense?
I think the difference is the characterization and the person by whom it was made. I think there's no question that this evidence was carried, you know, it had the authoritative quality that is set forth in the objective test. It's not an opinion, I don't believe. I don't believe it's an opinion, as counsel has stated. It's not an opinion of the juror. It is a fact based upon his historical experience. He said specifically, I've been through this. I had a DUI. I had vehicular looting. It's nothing.
You're saying it's not legal content. It's just factual material.
Well, I think it is legal. I think it's a little bit of both. You know, the analysis calls for. I think it is legal content in that he is holding himself as an authority and defining for the panel of jurors the legal consequences, the legal classifications of an offense based upon his own historical facts. I think it would be similar to an attorney serving on a jury. An attorney serving on a jury and kind of overriding the elements of the offense as prescribed by the court.
How do you distinguish this situation from the Harlan case, where the court drew a distinction between bringing a Bible into the courtroom and showing people verses, as opposed to people just bringing their religious views about the death penalty into the courtroom and discussing those? Isn't that suggest that there needs to be something extraneous actually brought into the courtroom, as opposed to just people sharing their life experiences?
No, because he did bring in something extraneous to the panel. He brought something extraneous into the deliberations that the court had specifically ordered as irrelevant, that could not be brought in.
I think would that mean that every time someone brings in a view about the law or the criminal process or courtrooms based on watching television shows show you courtroom drama and crime investigations 24/7 nowadays, it's almost impossible to conceive of a jury that wouldn't have a number of people who've seen that and might bring some preconceived notions. Once they start discussing that, is that extraneous information?
No, I think it's distinguishable because in this case, the authoritative quality, as I talked about before, Harlan, this person was holding himself out as an authority, as a person who personally experienced the facts of an eluding charge and made that assertion.
How is that different, though, from Kendrick, where you've got a professional engineer who comes in and essentially says, I'm going to do the calculation? Is their own professional background, essentially, to say what the speed was?
I think it's different because if you look at it, the context of the way this was done in our particular case, it was done when the eluding charge was not the only charge that was originally filed. When we went to trial on the morning of trial, there was a lesser included eluding charge. There was other traffic infractions, reckless driving, and some other traffic offenses. And when you take those out of there, we had a motion in limine hearing that's part of the record. Motion in limine about arguing for classification of offenses. And we said, Judge, we ought to be able to classify this offense as a more serious offense in light of the others. In light of the court's ruling dismissing all of those other charges, when the only charge that goes to the jury is this eluding charge, and the only evidence before the jury at a point where it was obviously a pivotal point in the deliberations, a person of authority has made an authoritative determination about the penalties and the classification of an offense in violation of the court's order. And I don't think that I think it's distinguishable from Kendrick in that there was no violation of the court's instructions, as specifically or on point as it was here. The very first instruction in this case is you shall not consider the penalty.
The counsel, you're not suggesting, are you, that every time that the jury violates the court's instruction without the use of extraneous information, that means a verdict must be set aside?
Certainly not, sir.
Then what difference does it make whether this was violative of the instruction or not?
I understand your point. I think that goes more to the prejudicial effect, probably. But, the question of whether or not this is extraneous, I think it's extraneous in that it was information from an authority about the legal matter, legal consequences of a charge that was brought in violation of the court's order with no ability to rebut it.
Ask you about the role of the trial court versus our role. You seem to be asserting that the determination whether this is extraneous information is a factual determination by the trial court, which we're bound by as long as there's evidence to support it. Is that correct?
Judge, I said that in my answer brief, and I think I have to concede that that it is a point of a matter of law that is certainly reviewable by this court. And I think I made that assertion both with regard to this instance and also with regard to the prejudicial determination of the dictionary definition, and I stand corrected on that. In preparing for today, it seems clear that the courts do look at that as a mixed bag of questions of law and questions of fact.
So the trial court's characterization of the information as extraneous is not binding on us, as opposed to a finding that, yes, this is indeed what the juror said, which would be.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's right.
What is the prejudice with the dictionary definition?
Part of the problem is that we don't know. But the dictionary definition, I think is problematic because we don't know what the dictionary definition was, and there is no evidence about that. But it is clear, both from the offer of proof that was referenced by counsel, from the trial counsel, and also by my own reference to dictionaries and, thesaurus and other web matters, there is no mens rea, no mental element that is infused into the definition of elude. And because this charge is called eluding, it's called vehicular eluding, and the term elude is used as a verb in the jury instruction itself, I think that needs to be taken in context with what happened. In my original motion for a new trial, one of the things I complained about, one of the things that Appley complained about, was that the jurors in their affidavits made a question of the court and proposed a question to the bailiff. What is the definition of elude? That issue was never really resolved by the trial court. And so I think that
it was never called the trial court's attention, was it?
It was, sir. I thought that it was fine. It was
During the deliberations.
During the deliberations, the affidavit suggests that during the deliberations, a question was posed to the bailiff.
Bailiff.
But apparently that question never made it back to the court.
But then you did raise it time. I understand you you raised it in connection with your motion.
Yeah, we raised it in connection with our motion, and it wasn't addressed by the district court. But when the court's making a determination of the non-exhaustive list of factors in Harlan and Weiser, I think that the court properly considered all of the other elements that were part of that process, the questions that were unresolved, the questions that were resolved, the questions that were posed to the court that counsel argued about, and the immediate outcry from the jurors, immediately following the verdict.
And it bears the burden of proof on prejudice, right?
Yes, sir.
So here, it's possible that the dictionary definition, which we don't know, but since we're looking at the world of possibilities here, it's possible it could be that it would be favorable to defendant, or it could be unfavorable to defendant. And counsel's submitted an offer of proof that suggests that it was maybe more favorable to defendant than otherwise. How can we say the defendant has carried his burden of proof under those circumstances? We're just left to speculate, and it may have been helpful to him, may have been harmful to him.
I think it depends on the expansive view that the court imposes on Rule 606B. I think that the courts recognize, and there was a lot of language in the cases about a rebuttable presumption of prejudice in light of juror misconduct, and that is the history in the law. The history is replete with instances where the court have made a rebuttable presumption of prejudice. In this particular case, although the trial court did not consider it, finding itself that 606B precluded it, the affidavits, objectively set forth facts stating that it influenced their opinion. So I don't think that
We can't consider that.
I'm sorry, sir.
We can't consider that.
Well, in light of my burden. I understand. In light of my burden, how can I prove a negative? How do I prove that something occurred when I don't have the evidence to do it? I think that that's why the court has, the case law suggests that there is a loose interpretation. It's reasonable possibility. A reasonable possibility that the defendant could be prejudiced by this outside consultation one thing that we do know objectively is that there was confusion in the jury room. And we know that the jurors afterwards complained, both by letter and by affidavit, that they felt there was an unfair verdict. But I think that this case is distinguishable, with regard to the... the fundamental fairness aspect of this is should inure to the benefit of my client. The appellant was found by the trial court to have been prejudiced by the jurors, and I think that to hold us to a burden different than the trial court.
I just interrupt you briefly. Didn't the trial court just say, "Well, I assume there was prejudice" on the dictionary definition?
I think the trial court found that there was a reasonable possibility of prejudice.
Okay.
It was based upon that reasonable possibility, based upon, in light of the fact that the trial court was there, he saw the evidence, and he saw he was able to make the court's own determinations about how well the evidence supported the verdict, the immediate outcry after the verdict, and the unusual situation of receiving all of these letters and all of these affidavits that set forth certain, all of the facts, some of which the court could and could not consider. I think the bottom line is that the court did not, in its order, consider anything that would be impermissible or an abuse of discretion. So as the court here looks at, the abuse of discretion by the court, I think that the trial court was satisfied that we met our burden. And I think
they're asking us to consider the letters that were sent to the judge.
No, I think that this panel can consider the effect that those letters may have had on the trial court, and consider that the trial court's ruling was made in the context of receiving all of its information, including the letters. Thank you. I'm out of time.
I wanted to quickly address the rebuttable presumption that's been requested this court consider, and I would note that in Weiser that was rejected, specifically indicating that 606 eschews rebuttable presumptions. That has been discounted since the beginning of our discussions here in Weiser back in 1987. I also wanted to bring up and cite to Harlan regarding text versus life experiences. Page 632 of that opinion is where the court addresses the difference between text versus the knowledge that the jury brings in. And it specifically mentions text, and that being the important factor being brought into the jury room. Specifically, the written word persuasively conveys the authentic ring of reliable authority in a way the recollected word does not. So they were distinguishing bringing in written from materials that a juror has within their own knowledge. I suspect what they're referring to is if a juror is well versed in scripture, they can cite that scripture. It's the fact that they brought in a Bible and essentially held it up to the jury that really conveyed that sense of authority that the spoken word doesn't otherwise have. Also, I would note that
Mr. Jones, I think you're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. Thank you both gentlemen for your argument this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.